the same question to Fuad Alani. As President Putin has been indicted for war crimes on this 20th anniversary of the Bush invasion, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, do you feel that President George W. Bush, that Dick Cheney, and other high-level U.S. government officials should be charged with war crimes for what happened to your country, to Iraq?
Yes, and as Sinan mentioned, the list of crimes is very long, especially about Iraq, but not only Iraq. It was funny to see the reaction of Joe Biden talking about the ICC going after Putin when Joe Biden said something like, yes, this is great. But at the same time, he said, but us, the USA, we don't recognize the ICC. And we know why. Bush would be on the list. A lot of people would be on the list. Even if we can see similarities, of course, with the invasion of Ukraine by Putin and Iraq at that time, on the illegal aspect, on the aggression of international law.
We have 10 seconds.
It's very important to remind that Bush should be judged, and it's not acceptable that he's still joking about Iraq.
Fuad Alani, French-Iraqi journalist, Sinan Antoun, Iraqi poet and author. We will link to your works. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. And streaming on the web at KBOO.FM.
You're listening to the final days of KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2 special programming. You can hear the unique content produced by KBOO creators throughout February and March at KBOO.FM/thrills. This Volume 2 special campaign ends on March 25th. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by donating now. Go to KBOO.FM/give or text the word KBOO to 44321. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a $200 million funding package to address housing and homelessness is on its way to the Oregon governor's desk for a signature. A Portland Police Bureau employee is charged with evidence tampering in a local murder case. And in international news, the UN's gold medal panel of climate scientists warn we are running out of time to stop more catastrophic effects of climate change. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 20th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Oregon lawmakers in Salem approved a $200 million funding package that aims to prevent people from becoming homeless and to provide more permanent housing to those who are already living without shelter. Two bills, HB 2001 and HB 5019, were passed by the Oregon House and Senate last week. They now go to Governor Kotek's desk for a signature. The Oregonian reports that the majority of the $200 million in funds are earmarked to help people in precarious situations stay housed. Those programs include landlord incentives, rent assistance, housing homeless youth, shelter beds, and rural county assistance. The bills also contain money for tribes, affordable modular housing, farm worker shelter, and trash pickup. Sybil Hebb, Oregon Law Center's legislative and policy director, told the Oregonian that while, quote, no one will say this is a solution to all the issues, these emergency funds are unprecedented. The funds are expected to be available quickly, some by the end of this month. That has led Oregon nonprofits who work on housing issues to be concerned about their ability to distribute this money to those who need it most. They cite their ongoing struggle to hire and retain staff as a significant hurdle to putting these funds to work in local communities. Currently, it is estimated that more than 3,000 people are experiencing homelessness in just the Portland area every day. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler says that the homeless encampment sweeps that he ordered last year have contributed to a decrease in the number of unhoused Portlanders struck by cars. However, a safety manager from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, known as PBOT, told the Portland Mercury that the mayor's conclusion is based on limited data and the decrease could just be within the standard range of variation year to year. PBOT went on to say that other factors could have been at play, but because they've only been collecting that data for 2 years, there's not enough history to identify a pattern. 63 Portlanders were killed in traffic crashes in 2022, and in 2021, 70% of those victims were unhoused at the time. The mayor has said that those statistics are a major factor in his decision to remove tents and other temporary dwellings from areas near the major roadways last year. PBOT spokesperson Dylan Rivera also told the Mercury that the agency would not be using the decrease in unhoused pedestrian deaths to create any policy recommendations. The window is closing on humanity's opportunity to avoid catastrophic harms from climate change. That's according to a new report from a United Nations panel of scientists who say that the relentless increase in global greenhouse gas emissions has put us on a collision course with environmental disaster. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, considered the gold standard of climate science, says the failure to curb the burning of fossil fuels has resulted in more frequent and extreme weather events and deadly impacts on nature and people in every region of the world. The report advises that the world needs to cut 60% of its greenhouse gas emissions by 2035 to keep warming at or below the accepted goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius. That would be 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. U.S. climate envoy John Kerry said in a statement that, quote, "We have the tools to stave off and reduce the risks of the worst impacts of the climate crisis, but we must take advantage of this moment to act now." If you had not already heard, former President Trump might be arrested for hush money payments, and Americans are taking action against banks investing in fossil fuels. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They're brewing a legal cocktail, Tony, to try to come up with some bizarre theory of the law never used by anybody in New York, just because they hate Trump. You know why they're doing this? Because they're afraid of Trump. That's why they're doing it.
Speaking at the Conservative Vision 24 gathering, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham says an arrest will just stoke the fire of former President Donald Trump's 2024 campaign. Trump says he expects the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to arrest him Tuesday for making hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels in 2016. In language some have compared to the run-up to the Capitol riot, Trump is calling for protests. A recent Quinnipiac poll found the former president still leads the pack in the primary, with nearly half of Republicans supporting him. A Monmouth University poll last year found 6 in 10 Republicans believe President Joe Biden won the 2020 election due to voter fraud. And based on a list assembled by the Washington Post, nearly 170 election deniers won statewide or congressional office last year. During a conference on threats to American democracy, UCLA law professor Rick Hassan said election conspiracy theories have become deeply entrenched in the party.
Election deniers won office in non-swing states, and many are in Congress. Local election officials have shared voting machine code with conspiracy theorists, and some local election boards have tried to require the hand count of ballots or refuse to certify election results.
Also Tuesday, environmental group Third Act plans nationwide protests against investments in fossil fuels. According to the Rainforest Action Network, large banks have put $4.5 trillion in those industries since the signing of the Paris Climate Agreement. Vanessa Arcaro with Third Act notes JPMorgan Chase, Citibank, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America have some of the largest holdings.
These four banks alone have provided well over $1 trillion in lending and underwriting to the fossil fuel companies that build things like new coal plants, fracking wells, gas export terminals, and more.
The Virginia Department of Environmental Quality's decision to fine Norfolk Southern less than $30,000 over a 2020 derailment has infuriated environmental groups there. The town of Salem's drinking water system had to halt operation for over a month when 16 coal cars spilled almost 1,400 tons of coal into the Roanoke River. Tim Sawinski with the Sierra Club of Virginia says the DEQ's fine won't stop it from happening again.
The response is disheartening because it doesn't have any implications of deterrence. There is no excuse for Norfolk Southern not to create more violations in the future if there's such a lackluster punishment, if you can even call it that.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An administrative employee of the Portland Police Bureau is facing charges for allegedly interfering with prosecution by tampering with evidence. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports that 53-year-old Karen Scher is accused of helping her husband, quote, destroy, alter, conceal, and remove physical evidence in relation to the April 2021 murder of Jack Decker in Portland's Goose Hollow neighborhood. Scher's husband, Bruce Scher, was later arrested for the murder and charged with first-degree manslaughter as well as second-degree assault. Karen Scher worked as an administrative supervisor for the Portland Police Bureau for 28 years and has been on leave since her husband was arrested. Both Bruce and Karen Scher were scheduled to be arraigned in Multnomah County Court today. There's been a major spike in pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S., and health experts say it's part of a worrying trend. Mike Moen reports from Minnesota, where there are legal efforts to try and bring down those numbers.
New data from the CDC show another increase in the nation's maternal mortality rate, and a Minnesota expert says there are several underlying factors. The report, issued last week, covers data from 2021. That year, deaths of pregnant women or new mothers in the U.S. went up by nearly 40% over the previous year. The agency says it follows gradual increases leading up to the pandemic as well. Dr. Stephen Contag is a professor in the Maternal Medicine Division at the University of Minnesota Medical School. He says improved reporting is playing a role, but he adds there are other issues at play.
Disparities in transportation, getting to healthcare, or differences in the number of obstetricians or health providers that can provide that care to patients in certain parts of the country.
And the findings show that Black women are especially affected by this issue. The maternal mortality rate for this population rose to nearly 70% compared to nearly 25% for whites. And some health experts say COVID-19 likely played a role in the 2021 spike and that the big jump may have peaked. But there's concern the other factors will keep pressure on these rates. And maternal death disparities have been documented in Minnesota as well. Contag sees hope in reversing trends, including changing how the state's maternal mortality review committee works. The panel is now operating under a mandate.
Now that we have that mandate, it's much easier to obtain the information that we need to review these cases in a fair manner.
He suggests that will lead to more recommendations that get to the root causes of these deaths. And earlier this year, a new Minnesota law took effect, expanding postnatal care by requiring public and private health plans to cover a series of care visits for up to 12 weeks after a baby is delivered. Two of those visits would have to involve comprehensive care. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
A measure to close a loophole in New Mexico's non-discrimination law cleared the state legislature last week and is awaiting the governor's signature. The Human Rights Modernization Act will prohibit discriminatory practices from publicly funded entities, including governments, school districts, and those who contract for them. Ros Brown spoke with New Mexico State Senator Carrie Hamblin, who co-sponsored the bill.
New Mexico's LGBTQ community will soon have additional protections after existing language in state law was updated by the legislature. Senator Carrie Hamblin co-sponsored House Bill 207 and says modification of the state's Human Rights Act means public institutions can no longer turn away or discriminate against people in the LGBTQ community without facing consequences.
It prohibits public institutions along with religious entities to discriminate against these protected classes if they receive money from the state, meaning our tax dollars are not going to discriminate against New Mexicans.
Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is expected to sign the legislation, which also updates language regarding people with disabilities by removing the term handicap from existing law. The governor has already signed legislation to prohibit out-of-state investigations targeting gender-affirming care. An openly lesbian senator, Hamblin notes the significance of New Mexico protecting the most vulnerable amidst the firestorm of anti-LGBTQ policies sweeping the country.
I'm recognizing how important representation is and visibility is, and being able to speak for those voices that are silenced, and that they have people who are looking out for them and who will protect them.
New Mexico's governor also signed a bill to override local ordinances that limit access to abortion procedures and medications already adopted in the cities of Hobbs, Clovis, and Eunice, along with Lee and Roosevelt counties. Republicans, a minority in the legislature, opposed the bill, saying it could put the state at odds with neighboring Texas, which has banned abortion at all stages of pregnancy with limited exceptions. This is Ross Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on social media's impact on tweens with David Rosenberg. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, let's talk about race. Your weather, not a bad day for the first day of spring, and tomorrow will be even better with sunshine and a high of 60. Tonight's low, around 36. Today in history, it was on this day in 2003 that air raid sirens were heard over Baghdad and the U.S. invasion of Iraq began. It was also on this day in 1932 that Amelia Earhart lifted off from Newfoundland to begin the world's first solo nonstop flight across the Atlantic by a female pilot. She landed in Ireland the next day. Our quote of the day is from Ms. Earhart, who said, quote, "Courage is the price that life extracts for granting peace. The soul that knows it not knows no release from little things." Food shortages and high costs were a serious problem for rural tribes in Alaska during the pandemic, but many were able to rely on bison herds to help during that time. And the Apache are headed back into federal court to protect a sacred site in Arizona from mining. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Food shortages and higher costs were among challenges experienced in rural Alaska during the pandemic. Old Harbor on Kodiak Island had its community bison herd and gardens to fall back on. These are part of efforts to make food more available and affordable. The Old Harbor Alliance, a group which includes the tribe, the city, and the village's Native Corporation, bought the bison in 2017 from a rancher on the other side of Kodiak who had bears preying on the herd. The bison were barged to Sitkalitik Island, a protected space just across from Old Harbor. A lot has happened since the 40 animals were brought to the island. The Alliance recently built a processing plant to butcher surplus animals. Old Harbor freezers are now full of bison meat, distributed to the community with priority to elders. Melissa Burns-Sabota, who manages the herd, says it's taught the community an important lesson.
Anything's possible. I mean, this was kind of a pie-in-the-sky dream that I've heard our leadership talking about since the early 2000s. And they kept on pushing for it, and we made it happen.
The Alliance took a big step in 2020 when they brought three bulls from the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in Montana to improve the herd's diversity. The bison, which were surplus animals from Yellowstone National Park, had to travel in trucks, airplanes, and barges to reach their final destination.
They've got their little harems, and they've been there for about 3 years, so we definitely have their offspring out on the landscape already.
As the herd continues to grow, the bison have fed Old Harbor Spear with hunts that bring the community together. The Old Harbor Alliance's long-range goal is to use surplus animals to grow the community's cash economy through visitor hunting permits and the sale of meat. Any profits will be used to support the meat processing plant and community gardens, as well as cultural programs which teach children about Aleutic language and heritage. A Michigan tribe has been awarded a $100,000 federal grant to study creating its own power utility. Mark Richardson has more.
The Little River Band of Ottawa Indians will use tribal energy capacity grant funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to perform a tribal utility authority feasibility study. Eugene Magnuson is the executive director of the tribe's economic development arm, Little River Holdings. He says the tribe sees operating a power utility as a way to exercise its independence, diversify its holdings, control its energy future, and reduce costs.
Energy sovereignty, I think, is the next arena that tribes are starting to look at. And one of the ways is going through solar, wind, and all those technologies that are available for tribes to get into.
There are currently more than 30 tribal utility authorities across the country, including the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan. The Little River Band was among 18 tribal entities funded during the Bureau of Indian Affairs' January round of grant awards. The tribe is located in Manistee County in the northwest part of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. The tribe's main income enterprise is the Little River Casino Resort north of the reservation. Magnuson says electricity to operate a casino can be costly.
The tribal utility entity was created to actually wheel power off the grid. And because of the tribal sovereignty, we could procure the electricity off from the grid at wholesale.
Magnuson says tribal leaders have not yet set a deadline to complete the study. I'm Mark Richardson.
A group of Apache people and their allies are headed back to federal court in efforts to protect the sacred site Oak Flat in Arizona from mining. On Tuesday, the Ninth Circuit will hear arguments in Apache Stronghold versus United States after the court decided last fall to hear the case in front of a full panel of 11 judges. The hearing is taking place in Pasadena, California, and will be live streamed on the court's YouTube channel. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office is warning the public about ongoing phone scams where callers say they're a Multnomah County Sheriff's Office lieutenant or sergeant. The scammer will sometimes use fake badge numbers and case numbers and then claim you've missed a grand jury summons and must pay a fine or be arrested. They will also often advise victims to stay on the phone and to not try and contact family or friends for advice. In one recent case, a person reported losing $1,500. The sheriff's office reminds you that they never conduct matters concerning warrants, jury duty, or fine payments over the phone. If you have received a call from someone claiming to be with the sheriff's office, never send money or engage with these callers in any way. If you're a victim of this scam, you can file a police report by calling the sheriff's department non-emergency number at 503-823-3333. There's a larger-than-ever demand for wood as an energy source around the world, and communities say that it threatens forests here in the United States. The European Union, in particular, has subsidized forest biomass as a source of renewable energy. Eric Tegedoff has more about a new wood pellet plant in Longview, Washington, that plans on serving that foreign demand.
Overseas markets could be harming forest in the U.S. Demand for wood pellets for biomass energy has increased dramatically around the world, especially in Europe, where burning wood is treated as renewable energy and heavily subsidized. The UK-based company Drax Industry plans to build a 450,000-ton-per-year wood pellet plant in Longview. Head of the Washington State-based nonprofit Pivot Point, Peter Riggs, says the region has a productive wood sector.
This new wood pellet plant proposed for Longview is very different. First of all, it's not for the domestic market. It's not making pellets for home stoves. It represents a substantial and entirely new source of wood fiber demand for export.
Riggs says much of the biomass would be bound for Asia. His organization Pivot Point also signed a letter, along with more than 100 others in the U.S. and Canada, calling for the European Union to stop incentivizing wood burning as renewable energy. Despite its label as renewable energy, Lauren Height, with the Partnership for Policy Integrity, calls burning wood from forests one of the worst activities for the environment. It releases emissions when burned and removes trees that store carbon. Height's organization also signed the letter to the European Union urging it to no longer classify forest biomass as renewable.
It's the money that's driving this system. If they change that policy, then this will no longer be subsidized and we can see a better future for our forests and for our climate.
Riggs says solar and wind energy were subsidized and the costs have gone down dramatically. However, the same is not true for forest biomass. He says plant operators have struggled to reduce the cost involved in sourcing, transporting, and burning biomass fuels.
If they're going to subsidize it, you kind of got to subsidize it forever. But with wind and solar, those are already cost competitive.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
More energy news as studies show air pollution from the nation's coal-fired power plants is responsible for 3,800 premature deaths a year. That's not including other health hazards that coal-fired power plants present. A new report out called Out of Control by the Sierra Club details the deadly impact of coal pollution. Eric Galatis has more on the story in Wyoming.
Thousands of lives are cut short every year because of air pollution from coal-fired power plants in Wyoming and across the United States, according to a new Sierra Club report. Rob Joyce with the group's Wyoming chapter says harmful toxins released from burning coal have been linked to a number of health issues, including increased asthma attacks and acute bronchitis, and in severe cases, can contribute to an increase in heart attacks and premature deaths over time.
The report also shows that while those living closest to the coal plants typically
really bear the worst impacts. Once those pollutants are in the air, they can travel long distances and impact communities hundreds of miles away.
Researchers found that pollution from America's coal-fired power plants is responsible for 3,800 premature deaths a year. The report lists PacifiCorp's Jim Bridger facility, operating since the 1970s in southwest Wyoming, as among the nation's most deadly. PacifiCorp has said it will continue operating two of the site's four units at lower capacities to reduce pollution levels until they are converted to natural gas as early as this year. The other two units will go offline in 2037. Joyce says while the transition away from coal-fired electricity will be good for public health, it adds economic uncertainty to communities and state agencies deeply tied to the old fossil fuel economy.
We need to be creative in our approach to prepare for these changes so that families can sustain themselves and also so that the land, water, and wildlife that everyone in Wyoming really values can continue to be enjoyed by everyone.
Just 18% of premature deaths from coal occur in the state where the power plants are located, and Wyoming is among the nation's top five exporters of coal-fired air pollution. Joyce says the report exposes just how dangerous the continued use of coal is for communities, public health, and the climate crisis.
The bottom line is that a transition to clean, renewable energy is not only good for combating climate change, but it will also immediately improve public health and save lives.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
As we heard earlier, the effects of unaddressed climate change are likely to worsen, and America's supply of native plant seeds is not up to the challenge. That's according to a new report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Eric Galatis has more.
Researchers with the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine spent 2 years studying the nation's supply of native seeds and found significant shortfalls. A new report shows that in order to respond to climate disruptions and keep ecosystems intact, significant work is needed to bolster seed production and distribution. Vera Smith with Defenders of Wildlife says native seeds are critical for wildfire and other recovery efforts.
Our insufficient supply is a major barrier to ecological restoration and other revegetation projects that we need to do across the nation in order to keep our lands healthy, natural, and resilient to climate change.
When seeds from plants that are native to a region impacted by wildfire are not available, non-native species are planted instead. But these species frequently are not able to adapt and thrive in foreign soils. If those plants fail to put down roots, rains can erode hillsides and make the recovery of watersheds that people, wildlife, and plants depend on much more difficult. The report calls for concerted action between tribal nations and the U.S. Departments of Interior, Agriculture, and Defense to build a more robust native seed supply chain as climate change brings more frequent and extreme weather events. Smith says significant investments, including funding in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, are needed to get the job done.
They need to build national seed warehouses that can meet their needs. They need to have robust national plant programs. They need to have botanists and ecological restoration specialists on staff.
Native plants are also more drought tolerant than non-natives. Smith says native seeds and plants are the foundation for healthy ecosystems and the environment.
And our native wildlife evolved to live with these native plants. It's what they eat. It's what keeps them alive. And if we lose our native flora, we risk losing our native wildlife.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
We have a few traffic and transportation notes as we wrap up this evening. The Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, plans to repave and expand sections of the I-84 highway between I-205 and Hood River. Travelers passing through the Columbia River Gorge should expect intermittent lane closures and traffic delays this spring and throughout the summer as well. The work includes repaving the freeway from I-205 to 169th Avenue and from 201st Avenue to Marine Drive. ODOT is also adding a new 2-mile section of the historic Columbia River Highway State Trail that will connect Viento State Park and Mitchell Point. That will lead to single lane closures on I-84 East until Memorial Day. The TriMet Max Red Line is also having work done, and that will result in nighttime lane closures on both I-84 and I-205, as well as occasional full closures of I-84 near 102nd Avenue. There may be several full weekend closures as well of I-84 at the I-205 exit later in 2023. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Michelle Coppola, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadoff, Nadia Ramlagan, and Eric Galatis. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. By the way, all of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can do that by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, where we're taking a closer look at social media's impact on tweens with author Claire Nader. Have a great night.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month only, the Governance and Policy Committee will meet on Thursday, March 23rd at 6 p.m.